This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 3, First Class Fielding. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, it's finally here. Mark Garraway's online coaching course, First Class Fielding, teaches you how to do some great throwing and some great catching, whatever level that you're at. But we also cover some other things, some spin bowling. We find out exactly how good Lavers is at dealing with an echoey room. And we also answer a question about the difference between biomechanics and practical coaching. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome again to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is half an hour of audio goodness. It's all about coaching cricket. It's all about playing cricket. And it's all about helping you improve whoever you are and wherever you are in the game. My name's David Hinchliffe. I run things around here. But helping me out are two very fine cricket coaches. The first of which is a man who has recently launched a brand new online coaching course on Pitch Vision Academy. And he's also the director of cricket coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garras.
Hello, David. How are you?
Yes, very well. I'm very excited about your course.
Yeah.
Been working hard to get it up and running.
You've done a very good job, mate. You've certainly made me look a lot better than I expected. So thank you for that. And you've edited it so well that it makes sense. So congratulations.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Before we do, let's introduce the other person in this triangulation. And it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers.
Hello, David.
In your usual echoey chamber today.
Yeah, echoing away. I might actually... Sorry, I may just see if I can reduce the echo slightly. I don't know if that's made any difference.
Well, or not. If you keep banging the table and moving the chairs, that'll get rid of the echo. That'll do it.
it'll take the attention off the annoying echoey noise.
Yeah, that's it. There's no echo now. Well done.
Do you know what? I never thought slapstick could work on a radio show. But
Mark Garraway. on a serious note, has that made any difference?
None at all. Oh. But we'll soldier on anyway.
Fantastic.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, so how are you anyway, Levers? Have you been up to anything exciting?
Yep, getting down to work and getting lots done, which has been good. So just getting on with things.
I'll give you a quick update on my last week trial and selection. We decided to go for 15 guys in the end. And as predicted, Garras, it was the last couple who were the real difficult ones. But we've given one lad the benefit of the doubt. I thought that he didn't look too keen to be part of it, and he wasn't exactly a sparkling talent. So I was not keen to have him in the squad, but the other coach was very keen to have him in the squad because he's the only one who claims to be a keeper. And so I said, "Well, we'll give him the rest of the winter to see how he gets on." But if you've got a good fielder, you can find a keeper, can't you? You don't have to, especially age 11. You don't have to pick the one who says, "I'm the wicket keeper," do you?
I was going to say, you know, you're working at 10s and 11s, and it's really important to give a few people the opportunity, isn't it? I mean, I didn't keep wicket until somebody missed the boat coming from the Isle of Wight to go to Southampton when I was 14. So, you know, you'll get a few people in there, won't you, to get behind the stumps over the next few months and see how they go.
Yeah, exactly. I've already been laying the seeds of saying who's tried it, who fancies it. So we're going to see how we get on with them over the next 8 weeks. We've got 8 more weeks with them, so we'll see how they get on.
Excellent.
Does he tune in, do you think, this boy who was on the fringes?
Does he tune in?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what made me reluctant. I didn't see a lot of him, but I'll tell you what it was that made me reluctant was that we were playing a game at the end, and it was a little bit of a knockabout game because it was, you know, if you hit it, you have to run, and everyone bowls and everyone fields and all that kind of thing. When it was his turn to bowl, he said to me, "Well, I don't bowl. I'm a wicketkeeper." And I said, "Oh, come on, just bowl your 6 balls, and we'll get on to the next person. Doesn't matter." And he had a little bit of a grump about it. And I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe he just doesn't fancy it. But he bowled, he did bowl anyway, even though he was quite grumpy. And his fourth ball was an absolute snorter. The guy nicked off, and it was the best ball of the day. And I said, brilliant, well bowled, you've done well there. And he still looked at me with a face of thunder, as if to say, you've made me do something which I do not want to participate in at all.
I could tell a similar story about a very close friend of mine who I'm actually best man for in a couple of months. And hadn't played cricket since his days at Wellington many, many years ago, and managed to get him out of retirement 4 or 5 years ago to play in a 2020 match. Mm. And kind of two-thirds of the way through the innings when not a lot was happening. The ball was thrown his way, and he just said, well, look, I can't promise anything. This could be really bad. And the guy, our captain, was like, don't worry about it. Just give it a go. Something's got to happen. First ball, he knocked middle stump out of the ground. And so a reluctant bowler with a bit of success. He then proceeded to bowl a 16 ball over.
Oh, my gosh.
With not just with wides, but with no balls. And he bowled 3 balls that cleared the keeper.
Nice. Well, do you know what, though? What I made me unsure about this kid was that attitude. Not of, oh, go on then, I'll have a go, because it doesn't really matter anyway. It's only a knockabout. It was, I'm not doing what I want to do, so I'm going to be cross about it. I didn't like that. But we've given him the benefit of the doubt. We've extended the squad from 14 to 15, and he's in. So we'll see how he does.
Yeah, you've always got the option to reassess in a month's time.
Exactly. So, Gareth, let's talk about your course, your online coaching course, videos and an ebook, of course. And it's been great fun putting it all together, because anyone who is a regular listener to this show will know that some of your ideas are against what you would say is the convention or what's in the coaching book or the tradition. And some of them are very much fitting in with tradition as well. But really, it's about effectiveness, isn't it? So if someone was thinking about ways of trying to improve their fielding and they were looking at your course, what would you say to them?
Well, first thing I'd say is that there aren't many resources that are available to us about fielding specifically. Most coaching that's done around fielding is activity-based rather than actual technical improvement based. So there's plenty of those things going on, but how to improve a cricketer at stop, diving, catching and throwing is something that aren't often taught. So going through some processes that have been taken from best practice, being taken from conventional coaching, being taken from baseball, and being adapted into individual ways of going about things is something that we've put together within this course. So if you're interested in making an impact as a coach, or you want to improve your fielding as a player, which I know that most players do, then it's definitely worth having a look at.
I tell you what fascinated me as I went through it was all the different aspects that I hadn't considered before. I mentioned them on the show many times, but difference in where you look when you're catching the ball, and the difference in your stance and your position of your legs when you're fielding the ball. It was something that you hadn't necessarily considered before. But when I was putting it into practice during these trial sessions with these under-11s, it was something that you could spot straight away as soon as you were looking for it, and that was very interesting to me.
And that's something that does come out having reviewed the footage again, because obviously I just did that in the way that I tend to go about things. But when you look at the footage again, you start to realise, yeah, that's quite interesting, because he is doing it very different, and I managed to pick out this particular point that if we exaggerated it, then it made a positive impact on their catching position or their start position, or whether they walk in or whether they don't walk in, which is one of the things that we cover on the course. And then, of course, when you watch the bigger game, you watch ODI cricket or you watch Test match cricket on the television, you start to see these little nuances around individuals. So if it applies to people that are playing in Test match cricket, obviously it applies to the kids that I work with on that day, who are school kids, the kids that you're working with within your trial system and your district squads, and for any club coach or school coach that's operating with their group of cricketers that they're working with.
Yeah, it's highly recommended. I mean, the videos are great. You pull off some fantastic demos, Gareth, towards the end with the runouts. We even got one of you doing one of the most difficult ones, the one that goes to your weaker hand and you have to spin all the way around to throw it. I enjoyed that one very much, getting that one in slow motion.
And it was amazing, you know, that I could pull that one off first time I did it as well, David, wasn't it? You know, we had no editing at all
No.
involved in that.
Just
That
had one
was
go.
one go, get it right, get out of here, you know, and that's the art of coaching, isn't it?
In fact, we've deliberately left in a couple of little things where it didn't quite go according to plan. Nothing too bad, but there's one great reaction from you where you attempt to hit the stumps, and I think it just misses by about a millimeter. And you do a proper ooh to the camera. It was so good that I had to leave it in. So keep your eyes peeled for that one, definitely. Okay, let's wrap up this loving with the yes/no round. That is three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more that the team want to say. I've got the first question here, so let's get started. Often in one day cricket, annoying bowling is enough.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question. There could be more eight-a-side cricket.
Yes.
Yes.
Third question. A good people person coach trumps a good technical coach.
Yes.
No.
Ooh, it's a close one. Okay, it's time for the questions section on the show. That's when listeners to this very show or readers to the Pitch Vision Academy website send in their questions using coach@pitchvision.com, and there's other ways you can do it as well. We'll tell you about those at the end of the show. And the best question wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. For example, Mark Garraway's brand new first-class fielding course. But this first question, it's not really a question. I've cheated a bit here because it was some feedback from AB that I've been trying to get into the show for a couple of weeks. And I thought, let's forget about doing it as feedback. Let's throw it in as a question and then we can have a discussion around it. And it was regarding an article, Gareth, that you posted about getting a spin bowler to bowl more spin by getting that hip rotation in. And here's what AB had to say about it. He says, biomechanically, there are three ways of generating rotations on a spherical object at the point of release. By applying pressure from the fingers, or the use of arm speed applied along a vector that doesn't pass through the center of the ball by means of a non-neutral shoulder alignment during the critical phase of the bowling action. In other words, finger spin, wrist spin, or a cutter. I guess what Mark is saying is that the use of the hips is important in generating speed without compromising on shoulder alignment, so it helps with the third method. I think this should be made clear, else we're going to end up with a situation where people think the movement of the hips actually have a direct effect onto the ball through some kind of magical action at a distance, which is clearly nonsense. So, let's start with how would you respond to that, Gareth?
Well, the first bit, the biomechanical elements of it, there is no doubt that that is absolutely spot on. And applying it into A, B, and C, being finger spin, wrist spin, and a cutter, which, you know, it wasn't related to seamers, it was related to spin, but the same principles apply. Absolutely spot on from AB. Really happy with that. But I think the point here is that most people that Sam's presented with, or I'm presented with, or any coach listening to the show presented with, turn up as an off spinner or a leg spinner, and generally have got a pretty good idea of how they hold the ball and how they rotate their fingers or move their fingers or rotate their wrists to impart some spin on the ball. But most of them turn around to us with that knowledge that they've already got. Is how can they spin it more? And the reason why the hips are very important is the hips play a vital part in the kinetic chain, and that kinetic chain is no different whether you're bowling spin, whether you're bowling pace, whether you're throwing, as we are on the coaching course that we just talked about, or whether you're hitting, particularly when you're hitting for distance. And it was very interesting to watch the role of the hips in AB de Villiers' world record innings recently. So the hips are massively important. And they provide a link to all of those things that AB's talked about because they're all the last part of the kinetic chain. The wrist and the fingers are the last part of the kinetic chain, and the way that we pass our momentum up through the kinetic chain to make those most effective is by using the ground forces up into the legs, then the hips rotate and they slow and stabilize. Then the momentum goes up the body through the torso into the shoulders. The shoulders rotate, slow and stabilize. And then the momentum goes up the arm into the final joints, the wrists and the fingers. So therefore, if we don't utilize the hip properly, then we're going to limit the impact of momentum going up the kinetic chain, which will reduce the pressure that can be put on a spherical object at the top, which means that the rotations will be less. So basically, he's absolutely spot on in identifying what the last part of the chain does. But the reason why the last part of the chain doesn't move so effectively and therefore doesn't spin it so much is because often the breakdown in the kinetic chain comes with the hips. And we see that in every discipline of the game. The research that the ECB did was all about that. And that there's a direct correlation to the effectiveness of the hips into the ability or the effectiveness of somebody to do the three things that AB has identified. So when AB says that the movement of the hips actually doesn't have a direct effect on the ball, it does. It goes through the kinetic chain. So the hips are a crucial part of that. Most kids will come to you having a leg spin grip and having a leg spin action, but it doesn't mean to say they're going to spin it. How can you help them? You can have a look to see whether their hips are allowed to move and the body allows their hips to move, because if that happens, then they'll be able to transfer their momentum up the kinetic chain into that gift, which is a wrist spinning action, or into the gift, which is a finger spinning action. So that's the way that we best support it.
And I suppose the strongest defense of that argument is to say, do you see a situation where players come to you, you explain to them about the hips, and maybe you do that those drills that you mentioned in your original article, and they go away thinking that there's some kind of a magic in the hips and they don't have to worry about their fingers anymore? I would argue that doesn't happen. Does that happen with you, Lavis?
I would say that any time you discuss the hips, and I know Garrus would be exactly the same, that Garrus would do so and he would explain. He wouldn't just say, do this with your hips, you will get an outcome. He'll very, as he does on the show all the time, he'll very much explain the process and how the hips will move and have an impact on the shoulders, and subsequently moving up through the kinetic chain, as we mentioned already. It will work through to the ball. So I don't think at any stage anyone's under the illusion that there is an unknown quantity or a magical action, as has been referred to, that's being involved, that's causing this. So I think as long as there's a full explanation given, then children will be well aware, or adults will be well aware of why they're doing it, the benefit of it, and how it fits into the overall action of a bowler. I would also say, moving on probably a little bit further away from just the revs on the ball, but more into the direction of the revs on the ball, that you'll find that the more you work with your hips as well, particularly as a finger spinner, the easier it is to rotate your body into a position where those revs that you are generating can actually be more directed down the ground. So you can generate overspin, which is one of the things that most young spinners as finger spinners struggle to do. Who generally bowl undercutters or side spinners and struggle to spin the ball on better surfaces. So I think the hips is really important for the hips are really important for generating increased levels of spin, but also potentially improving the effectiveness of that spin once it actually lands by putting you in a position to allow you to get the ball spinning forwards a little bit more.
So the hips are definitely important, and I think it's. I don't think there's many situations where players think that it's not the fingers or the wrist that's the spin. I think more often than not, young players especially assume that that's where all the spin comes from. And so the job of the coach is more to demonstrate that it is part of a chain, a kinetic chain, which is an article we've discussed this week, what a kinetic chain exactly is, that chain of movements where energy is passing from one movement to the next as efficiently as possible. If you assume it's just the fingers, you're not going to get as much spin as if you use your entire body to put spin on the ball.
Absolutely. And whether you're spinning, whether you're hitting, whether you're bowling fast, or whether you're throwing, often the breakdown in the kinetic chain is how the hips are blocked or not allowed to operate optimally. So you talk to Stephen Jones about fast bowling, and it's all about placing the feet in the right place to allow the hips to do their business. You look at AB de Villiers' hit the other day when he was clearing the ropes with a pass time. His right hip was allowed, because of the way that he places his feet and he moves his body, to rotate, slow and stabilize, and chuck all of that momentum up the kinetic chain, which ends up in his hands and his bat speed. That's exactly the same. And whether you're doing spin or bowling fast or throwing or hitting, it's exactly the same principle. Often when people can't get quick hands, when people can't bowl fast, when people can't spin the ball as much as they would like to, one of the first points that you can look towards is, what are the hips doing? Are the hips being allowed to do what they're designed to do, or are they being blocked? And that was the whole emphasis for the article.
That's probably largely down to most cricketers excel when it comes to the way their arms and wrists work. So the hips have a vital role in the same way that other body parts will do. So they're not necessarily, I wouldn't say they're much more important, but they hold up, carry a lot less focus and attention. And that's why they're often the first ones that give way, or the first ones that are not as effective as other body parts. Most spinners work well with their arms, work well with their fingers, work well with their shoulders to a degree, but because of the lack of awareness, it is often the hips that is the point that's been missed out. And as Gareth said, they're batting, throwing, bowling fast, people work well with their arms, it's often the hips that are neglected. So that's why they're the common blocker, possibly.
Yeah, there's definitely a blocking thing there. So if I see a spinner, particularly a finger spinner, who wants to spin the ball more, who holds the ball in a technically correct way and has got a good action from his wrist up through the end of his fingers, and he's not spinning the ball, then one of the first places that I'll look to is to see if his hips are blocked. If his hips are blocked, then we unblock them, and then we see what the effect is on the end result. Because the more momentum you can transfer up the kinetic chain into that final bit, the more effective you're going to be.
And that's really the difference between the practicalities of coaching and the theoretical side of biomechanics. There's a crossover between them, but the practicalities of coaching often get lost in a technical biomechanical explanation. And when you're coaching, you want to keep it as simple as you can for someone, rather than getting into the details of applying rotations onto a spherical object.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely. And, you know, what AB's done is he's listed those things, and I can't pick holes in any of it, because it's right. You know, what happens in that last chain, but it's about how we make that last chain optimize itself, I suppose. And that was what the whole article was about. So, you know, I wouldn't coach anybody, however detailed and precise and scientific they were, by using the language that he used there, because it wouldn't work. Or if it did work, it would work for one in a million. And you know, we have to make it, in, as you say, David, a simple way as possible to reach the masses. And whether it's biomechanics or anything else, or tactics sometimes, which can be a bit complex to somebody who's only just started the game, we need to take the garbage out of it, I suppose, take the nonsense chap out of it that sounds impressive when we talk as coaches, and make it layman's, make it effective to that person that's ultimately going to put that performance down on the pitch. And it doesn't have to be a youngster. You know, if I talk to Andrew Flintoff or Matthew Hoggard about biomechanics, they'd turn off. If I talked about how to bowl with an underpinning of biomechanical language and with an intent to make them more effective, then they'd listen with their ears as open as they possibly could be. You know, so that's the way that we've got to go. We've got to understand biomechanics, but not necessarily preach it.
It's very much the same as how we use statistical analysis, isn't it? You can put a load of numbers and figures in front of someone, which are all relevant to them and are all key to their development. But if you don't interpret the numbers for them, and if you don't interpret the information, it doesn't make sense to them. So it's same with biomechanics, same with physiology of cricket. A lot of the detailed physiology of cricket, which hopefully most coaches have a reasonable awareness of, it's not relevant to the knowledge bank of a fast bowler. He has to know what works for him, and if he can dig a little deeper and find out a little bit more about how the processes work, then that's great. But ultimately, you've got to put it into his terms, What does he understand? What will get him putting these physiological processes in place in the right way? Or what will get him interpreting or understanding these statistics? It's taking complicated information and making it relevant to an individual.
Next question is from Bibhuti. Bibhuti's got a simple question, really, but we're speaking about terminology and not really understanding what we take for granted as terms that everyone will understand. Bibhuti says, I want to write, what do you mean by drift and dip on the ball? So let's talk about that, shall we? Just as a primer for people who aren't quite sure when it comes to spin bowling, what is drift, what is dip, what's going on?
Drift and dip are the spinner's version to a degree of swing for a seamer, in that it's the deviation through the air. So drift is obviously a lateral deviation. So for any bowler, that's the ability to get the ball moving left and right in the air. And dip is clearly the precursor to additional bounce. And that is the ability to get the ball dropping sharply or sharper than the normal trajectory would suggest. And subsequently, shortening the length of the ball or its perceived length and then getting extra bounce as well. So in essence, that's what they are.
They're quite magical terms, aren't they? Sort of, if you're not a spinner yourself, you know, if you're a batsman especially, and you hear a spinner's got drift and dip, you kind of think to yourself, oh, he's going to be doing not only spinning the ball off the pitch, but making it move in the air and deceiving me in lots of different ways. And I guess that's the important part of it, isn't it? It's finding ways to deceive the batsman that aren't necessarily the ball deviating off the pitch. The ball moves in the air in some way or another.
Exactly right, David. And there's been some great examples of bowlers like this over the last 15, 20 years. And ultimately, what they use these two things, these two bits of deception, I suppose, a different way for the ball to travel through the air, is to keep them in the game for as long as possible, because a lot of the time the pitch conditions, particularly in certain parts of the cricketing world, like England, for example, don't offer consistent levels of spin throughout a game of cricket, whether it be over 50 overs or in longer formats of a game where you're playing 2, 3 or 4 days. So somebody like a Dan Vettori is a classic example of a bowler who could bowl and pick up wickets or hold an end up in the first innings of a test match, for example, where really there was nothing for him to work on in terms of surface. So the ball was not going to break off of the wicket significantly. Therefore, he developed his skills at making the ball move laterally through the air to drag the batter and often their eyes to a part of the pitch that they don't want them to go to. And then obviously the dip being the thing that deceives batters in the air about when the ball's going to land on the pitch or where the ball's going to land on the pitch and when it's going to come into the contact zone. And he was an absolute master at being effective throughout a game of cricket, because he got on top of those two skills and worked on his ability to generate lateral movement and also a dip prior to the ball bouncing, which would deceive people. He got almost as many wickets in the first innings as he did in the second innings at the beginning of his career, which is a real asset. And in fact, for a lot of Swanee's career, he would be more effective in the first innings than the second innings, because he got very good at bowling on greener wickets and picking up wickets, bowling slightly differently, but really focusing on overspin rather than side spin in the first part of a game, and then combining the two in the second innings when there was more of a ground surface for the ball to grip hold of and break off of the pitch.
And it all stems, doesn't it, from putting a lot of revolutions on the ball, just like spinning the ball off the pitch. If you're spinning the ball more in the air, then you're going to get more dip and you're going to get more drift.
It all helps. And then you've got, if you want to get into real detail, you're then looking at the alignment of the seam to maximise that dip and drift, and the real craft bowlers, the guys that have been doing it for years, and generally it is people that have been bowling over and over again. And I remember back to a lot of the local league bowlers that may be playing into their 40s. They've got real mastery of the alignment of the seam, where they put the shine to get different results out of the ball in the air as well as off of the pitch. And I played with a guy over in South Africa. We had Claude Henderson, who's now in the coaching setup of South Africa, was a very young spinner playing cricket for our club side. And he would bowl at one end, and a gentleman called Ferdy Dubois who used to play first class cricket over in South Africa, who would have been, I would suggest, no less than 48 when they were playing together. They would bowl at opposite ends and I would keep wicket. And Claude had height and pace through the air and got the ability to spin the ball and the wicket was right. But throughout a game of cricket, I always felt more in the game with Thirdy, because Thirdy had worked on all of his mastery. He'd bowled so many balls. He'd worked out how to deceive people through the air just by doing it over a huge number of years. And he would generally get wickets consistently through an innings or through a game, whereas Claude would come into his own when the wicket suited him. So I thought it was a fascinating contrast between young and old, the experienced and the inexperienced in the same team. Both fantastic bowlers and a joy to keep wickets in.
Okay, there's a primer for you, Babita. I hope that helps. Right now, it's time for the soapbox. That is 60 seconds on the clock and an uninterrupted discussion on any topic that one of the member of the team wants to talk about. So the stopwatch is ready, Gareth, and it's over to you this week for your soapbox.
Well, this week I'm going to do a tribute, actually, because a good friend of mine has passed away this week. He's done an incredible amount for cricket coaching in this country and throughout the world, really. His name was Michael Fordham, and Michael was a member, in fact, ran the Bradford Business School, part of the university set up there, and ECB Level 4 coaches would go up there and do their first three modules under the tutelage of Michael, which was all about communications. It was all about understanding the other person, all about analysing the interactions that we have whenever we talk with people to make us more effective as communicators. Because even the people that had the best technical advice that they could possibly give, if they could flex their ability to deliver it for the recipient's benefit, then they're obviously going to become better coaches. And then the interesting thing about Michael for me is that when you look at the people that have gone through 14 years of level four, they are littered, not just amongst the first class game in this country, but among the international game that's been played over the last 10 or so years. And every single one of them went through three modules with Michael about how to be better communicators, from the likes of Tom Moody, Peter Moores, Paul Farbrace, Otis Gibson. All of these guys have coached internationals. Andy Flower at the top level. They've all gone through working with Michael and they flex their communication to make themselves more effective coaches. So from all of us, Michael, thank you very much for everything that you've done and rest in peace.
Okay, that's the end of the show for this week. We are going to get out of here. Before we go, we're going to wrap up with our competition winner. That, of course, is the prize of the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And we had two questions. One was a bit of a cheat. It was more of a comment from AB, but it prompted a good discussion about spin bowling. And then we had Bibutu's question about what exactly drift and dip is. And I think that's important to bear in mind that not everybody understands everything that we say, and sometimes we have to do a little primer on these things. But Gareth, which one did you prefer this week?
Well, I love the fact that we've been talking about spin all the way throughout our questions this week.
Brilliant.
But this week I'm going to go with AB's question, because it was a challenge. He challenged me, which I always like, and hopefully we've come up with stuff which supports his argument around biomechanics, but also might enlighten about how he best supports that last chain of the kinetic chain to give his bowlers the best chance of giving it a big old tweak.
Great stuff. Well done, AB. And I'll get in touch. I'll drop you an email to discuss how you want to claim that prize. It'd be interesting, because AB's always very strong in his opinions. Also see his comments about last man stands cricket, which we probably need to talk about at some future point. Now, if someone wanted to send in their questions to the show, Gareth, what would they need to do to get in touch with us?
They could give us a call, David, on 0203 239 7543. Or drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
That is correct. There's other ways to get in touch with us through social media. Twitter is at pitchvisionacad. Find us there. And if you go to Facebook, then type in facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy, and you'll get all kinds of crazy stuff going on there. You can post your question that way as well. If you want to listen to this show every week, then you can subscribe in all the usual ways. Just open up your podcast app, do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, click on that subscribe button. If you want to do it in the old-fashioned RSS feed way, you can go to pitchvision.com/academy and click on the podcast link, and you'll have all the details for how to subscribe in there. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Labus.
Thanks, guys.